pad up. It's the Australian Cricket Podcast, and here are your hosts.
Welcome to the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, aka Menners, and in this episode of the show, I have an extra special guest for you. I am lucky enough to be joined by one of the great characters in Australian cricket. He played 7 tests for Australia, 123 one-day internationals, 15 T20 internationals. He won the coveted Cricket World Cup twice in 2003 and 2007. Welcome to the show, George Bradley Hogg. Welcome to the show, Hoggy. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Well, I'm going very well, mate. Can't wait to get over to Melbourne and start the Big Bash in about 20-odd days.
Yep. How's your training coming along for the BBL?
Training's been going really well. I can't complain. I'm probably feeling a bit fitter than what I did 5 years ago. So, yeah, very happy where I'm at the moment. Just hopefully the bowling stands up this year.
Now, Hoggy, I just got back from Adelaide. I was lucky enough to see the day-night test, and I had your new book, The Wrong, and as my companion for all the breaks. It was an excellent read. I have to say, I mean, your career just spans so long. It was such a good read. You know, hearing some, you know, from characters in the 90s all the way to now, just a fascinating book. You must be happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, it was a long process. I didn't think it would take that long, but it took over a year and a half. And it was just a good feel just to be able to be in a position where you could write a book. So it's a great privilege, one, to be able to do that, don't know where that word came from, but it was just a great privilege to be able to be put in a position where someone wanted me to write a book. And I've got to say, it was Greg Rowden who wrote the book. I just did the verbal stuff. So let's not get too carried away about me writing the book. It was more about therapeutic stuff, just going back and revisiting your cricket career and just going, wow, did all this happen? And that was the journey that it took me to get where I am now. So it was just a great thing to do over the year and a half to just be able to go back through your career and see the road that I took.
Now, I want to ask you about some of the different captains you had throughout your cricketing career, because, I mean, when you made your debut, Mark Taylor was your test captain, and then played under Steve Waugh. How did you find both of those blokes as captains?
Oh, look, each player that I've played with, you know, they've all got their little different knickknacks and different personalities and ways about going about their business. So Mark Taylor, he was more relaxed, and probably Steve Waugh was one of those ones that led from the front, had that toughness about him. And the way that he was playing, he expected everyone else to play. If he couldn't do it, he wouldn't expect you to do it. Whereas Mark Taylor was pretty relaxed, especially in my first couple of games. I had no idea what I was doing out international cricket at that stage back in 1996. I'd only just started bowling left-arm leg spinners for 2 years, never done it before, let alone trying to bowl it, trying to work out how to get batsmen out and know what I was doing. It was a difficult art to take up in those first 2 years, and the way he led me in that tour of 1996 to India was unbelievable, especially with the lack of knowledge that I had. So the way he handled me was exceptional and made me feel very welcome.
Yeah, you talk about that first test in 1996 in India. I remember that really well because it was actually one of the first tests from India televised on Australian TV. So we all got to watch it. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm sure Hoggy was bowling medium pace last time I saw him. And then all of a sudden you're bowling left arm leg spin.
Yeah.
how long was it before you started? How long was it when you made your test debut bowling spinners?
Oh, look, 1994, I bowled them in the nets. That was February 1994. 1994, 1995, I started. Yeah, so it was basically 2 years. 1994, 1995, I started bowling a bit of part-time out in the middle. So I was bowling a lot for club cricket, but at Shield level, I was sort of classed as a batting all-rounder. So it was only 2 years before I represented my country that I was bowling the left-arm Chinamans, and I'm glad I did. Otherwise, I definitely wouldn't have played as a bat.
That's amazing that it's 2 years you're already in the test side. Now, I want to go back to Steve Waugh. He sounds like the Iceman from what everyone says, but it seems like he likes to pull a few tricks in the background. Yeah. I heard he stitched you up.
Yeah, he stitched me up a couple of times actually, but he's got a really wicked sense of humour. It's a dry humour, and it's unexpected, especially when the way that you see him out on the field, and you hardly ever see a smile come to his face while he's actually playing a game of cricket. So you're thinking, right, he's probably not that much of a humorous character, but when you get him behind closed doors and in the change rooms when the game's done and dusted, he can be quite funny. So yeah, there were a couple of pranks that he played on me very early in my career, and I was a very gullible character, as probably you worked out with the book. And you know, if someone said jump, it was just a matter of how high they wanted me to jump. So I was susceptible to a lot of blokes out there playing pranks on me. Yeah, that's just a naive boy from the bush.
Yeah, and what about the other captains? So you had Ricky Ponting as your one-day captain in the 2003 and 2007 World Cup. Did you ever have Michael Clarke as a captain?
Look, I don't think I played under Michael Clarke. I played under him as a vice captain, but never had the luck to play under him as a captain. And each to their own. And you've been given the job, you've been handed the job from the hierarchy for a reason. And I think Cricket Australia saw that in all captains, they saw the best out of those players and saw the leadership qualities out of those players. So if you get named as a captain for Australia, you've got to respect it. You've got to accept it, and the rest of the team have got to accept it. And it's a great honour. And I think all captains that have done the role have accepted it and respected it.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you about a captain of your state side that, reading through the book, I'm gathering wasn't your favourite skipper. I'm talking about a big Tom Moody. It just seemed that you had a sort of fracturous relationship with him. Did you ever patch that up?
Yeah, no, it's patched up. But you've got to remember that when going through the books, it's my perception of it at that particular time. And as a young player coming through the ranks, you sort of lose focus, and all you start thinking about is your journey, I'd just come back from a tour from India in that particular scenario that you're talking about, and all I could think about was playing for Australia, and I lost that focus and lost the values of being a team man there for a while, and I didn't really see that I was going down that path. All I could see was where my career was. I'd forgotten about my teammates, and I was a very difficult customer to captain at that stage. So if you read it, it does look like there's a sort of a touchy relationship between the both of us. But by the time you get to the end of the chapter, you realise that, I could have done things differently. And, that's the idea of the whole book, is to really expose my vulnerabilities. And there's a lot of humour in there, but it's also to sort of expose my vulnerabilities and just, that journey that I took. I had to change things within my personal space to make sure that I was adaptable and fitted into all the teams that I was getting selected for.
Well, you talk about, opening up to your vulnerabilities. I felt the most powerful part of the book was when it was sort of your first retirement from the Test, when you retired from Test cricket. I felt the book really conveyed your sense of confusion and anxiety about the whole change in your life. How was that for you, opening up to Greg about that and talking about was obviously a really difficult part of your life?
To be honest with you, I found it very easy to open up. I go out and talk to kids about resilience and just striving to have their journey of life, and just explaining to them that you're going to have your ups and downs. And when it comes to question times, they really ask me some really touching questions where I've really got to open up and be honest. And, it goes to my dark times, the things that I am not too proud of that I've done in my life. And, if you're going to go and do that role and speak to kids and try and be a bit of a role model, you've got to open up and say, right, well, I did this, I did that, and I'm not proud of it, but this is how I got around it to get my life back on track. So, for me, it was pretty easy to open up. I don't I don't find anything behind closed doors. Obviously, there's a few family issues there, which I opened up to a certain extent to protect the kids. But other than that, anything that goes with me is fully in the book. So, I found it very easy.
Yeah, now, on an earlier podcast, I had a guest on, Gus Warland, and he was talking about the way cricketers, you know, it's a hard thing to come forward and talk about your feelings. And I guess, you know, when you were going through this dark time, you probably felt it was hard to come out and talk to anyone. Do you think that's changing in the Australian landscape? Do you think cricket dressing rooms are getting more open and people can talk about their feelings more?
For me personally, whether it be in a shearing shed on the farm or in a cricket team, I think the way that I was brought up, and I really had a great upbringing. I just felt the way that I am, I don't think I would have opened up to anyone. It was just one of those things. I'm a man, I'm tough, I can get through anything, and this is my problem, this is my issue, and I'm going to deal with it behind closed doors. But at the end of the day, you do need help. If you've got close friends, it's always good just to speak to them. For me, it was great to write it down, actually. I find it better to write it down, but it's also good to talk to close friends. My best mate, who I saw the other day, who's just finished reading the book, said, "I had no idea that you were going through this," and he was a little bit disappointed that I hadn't spoken to him about it. And that was 6 years ago. So he had no idea that I went through that till he read the book. Same with my brother, same with my mum and dad. So that's how closed off I was.
Well, it's good that it's, I think it'll hopefully encourage, you know, other cricketers who read the book, if they grab a mate, if they've got something to talk about.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether you're a cricketer or a labourer, or even women for that instance, or even kids. If you've got an issue, find someone that you can trust, someone that you can just lay your head on their shoulder and let it all out. You feel a hell of a lot better, and the weight's off your shoulders, and you can move forward. You've already started that journey of fixing the situation or moving into a more positive space. So, yeah, it's just not about cricketers. It's about anyone out life that's going through a tough time.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, there's some really good stories in the book. Winning the World Cup twice must have been a personal highlight for you. But also, I think you describe it like when you win a game for Australia, like a kid getting chocolate.
Yep.
Which seems like a pretty accurate description, that sort of all-encompassing joy you get as a kid. Yeah. Is that how it felt, those moments when you won the World Cup?
Well, look, playing cricket for Australia just felt like a kid on chocolate. If I really want to describe it to the biggest extent, my mum makes great sponge cakes. She puts cream in it with a banana in it, and if she puts chocolate icing on it, that's what it's like winning for Australia. The sponge cake with the cream and banana is just playing for Australia. But if you win, the chocolate icing is the stuff on top. It's just a great feeling. It's a great honour to be able to represent your country. And really, when you get to that stage, you are role models. You're representing you're representing your country, and you've got to do it right. All sportsmen, as they're coming through, they dream of playing for their country. They dream of playing for the top team in the country, and you don't realise the impact that you do have with society or with kids that are watching you. So it's very important that you take it with a huge responsibility that you're doing it the right way and setting the example for the next generation coming through. And I guess that's probably, we lost our way with Australian cricket over the last couple of or 5 or 6 years, and I think just with the last test match, the Adelaide test match, it just looked as though that pride of the baggy green has come back to the come back of age of what it was like many moons ago. So I'm not having a go at those players that have gone through that period. It was just an environment that was that they were put in. They all wanted to represent their country, but they probably would have liked to have done it a little bit differently.
And what about the structures in cricket? I mean, you've been around for so long. Do you think that, you know, that they've messed with the pathways at Shield level? You know, you talk to grey cricketers, they seem to be alienating some of the older players. Do you think they've got to fix it up and go back to the way it used to be?
Oh, there's definitely got to be some changes. I just played a great game the other day where we had one bowler in our team that could only bowl 10 overs in the day. So we've got 90 overs to bowl in that day. The other team had three bowlers that were only able to bowl 10 overs. So they had three bowlers, that's 30 overs. They had to find another 60 overs. One, it's not good for the game. It's not good for batters coming through. They're not facing the best bowlers. And these bowlers aren't spending time out in the middle doing what they're striving to do. And that's been first-class bowlers and even international bowlers. So I think we've got to change our ways a little bit. I think we've got to start at a young age, start teaching kids the basics of the game of cricket, even to the age of 8 years of age. And hopefully by the time those kids are at 8, 9, 10, that you've been teaching them, when they get to the age of 15, 16, 17, when they've got a bit more testosterone in their bodies and they don't want to listen to mum and dad or anyone like that, and they think they can go do it on their own, at least they've got that basics. At least they've got a game plan out there and they can go out and take the game on. And by the time they get to first-class cricket, they should be ready for it. They should be able to know how to make 100. They should be able to know how to construct a spell and bowl tightly. And I think we've lost our way in that regard. I think we're too heavy coaching at the top end where it shouldn't be needed, but we should be putting more coaching resources back out the bottom end around the ages of 8, 9 and 10.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I mean, that's one of the things everyone's saying, that the high performance unit's not really pulling its weight.
But on that, I wouldn't say it's a high performance not pulling their weight. Each player owns their game. Each player wants to play first class cricket. Each player wants to make a living out of it. Now they own their game. As they come through, each player's got a mentor, their own personal mentor. It's up to them to utilise those resources to the best of their ability. You can have all the technique, you can have all the coaching staff out there, but if you're not mentally tough, you're not going to make it. So at the end of the day, it's the player's ownership of their game rather than all the coaching staff out there. So that's why I say that we've got too many coaches.
So they've got to strengthen the grade scene again and get the second 11 Shield games back up to being competitive rather than sort of practice matches. I mean,
exactly right, and that's where they need more. That's where they need a lot more coaching resources and just to help out those grade teams, even more so in the junior ranks than the senior ranks.
Now, before I let you go, you've got to help me with a couple of things. Now, firstly, you've played in 9 T20 teams across 7 countries. You played in a lot of the big T20 franchise leagues all around the world. Now, I want you to help me with this question.
Hang on, did you say 19 T20 teams?
No, 9 T20 teams.
Yeah, 9. Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought if
that's
it was
what it
19,
said in your book.
If it was 19, I'm not a wanted character, am I?
It'd be a few more.
Really?
Now, when you played in the IPL and the Big Bash, I thought last season the Big Bash, the standard of play improved a lot, and it seemed to almost be at the same level of the IPL as the on-field standard. What's your thought on that? Do you think the BBL and the IPL are roughly the same level, or is the IPL still ahead?
Look, each is a different competition. You've got one where the IPL, you play each other twice and it goes for 2 months, whereas the Big Bash only goes for a month or slightly less, and you're only playing 7 games. So, yeah, it's very hard to describe. We're very lucky with the Big Bash that it's over Christmas period. That's our holiday period. And it gets the public involved. So that makes it an even bigger spectacle. I think the marketing side and the entertainment that's off field as well does wonders for the game. And the way that it's telecast on the TV and radio, it's just an exciting package. It's an entertaining package, and that's what cricket's all about. Yeah, it's great to go out there and win, but if you're not entertaining, if you're not providing good entertainment for those viewers, you're not going to have a decent product. And I think the Big Bash is the cricket out in the middle has been fantastic, but also the entertainment off field has been brilliant. The IPL, I think the cricket is absolutely magnificent over there. You've got different conditions. You've got different wickets where all the skills have to be on show throughout the tournament. You've got to be able to play spin. You've got to be able to play pace. And you also have those flat wickets where batsmen can really dominate. So the skills over there are tested a little bit more for the players. But at the end of the day, both competitions are head-to-head, side-by-side. So, yeah, it's at the end of the day, it's entertainment. And I think the IPL, especially in the first 6 years, did exceptionally well with their entertainment off-field. They're still doing it reasonably well now, but I think it's not as good as what it was in the first 6 years. But the Big Bash, they got to make sure that they don't get too greedy with the product that they've got now. It's perfect as it is, and the public are absolutely loving it. So, just little tweaks here and there to improve it, but don't try and drastically change it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the Big Bash. I'm actually doing a podcast all about the Big Bash. It's called the Big Smash Cricket Podcast, and we're going to be reviewing the whole tournament. And one interesting thing, Hoggy, is you're a passionate West Australian. Comes through in your book. How's it going to be when you line up against the Scorchers for the first time? What's that going to be like playing against your home state?
Oh, obviously, you're going to have mixed emotions going through it, but at the end of the day, once you cross that white line, it doesn't matter who I'm playing for, I'm playing to win. So, it's still going to be very competitive, and, decisions are made to, throughout your career, throughout your journey, and, sometimes you've got to make the tough decision to, make sure that you're still playing at the highest level. And, that's the decision that I've made, and I'm really looking forward to the journey over in Melbourne. And look, at the end of the day, I've been with WA for 23 years. I've played against Victoria every year of that 23 years. And because of that Aussie rules rivalry, you could say, there's always been a tough rivalry between Victoria and WA. It's probably the worst rivalry in the country in cricket, in a sense that you really go hard at each other. And to be sitting on the other side of the fence is just going to be a wonderful experience to see how the other side do it and how they cope with it. And look, with stuff that I want to go move on to moving forward, I've got a wider range of experience now being able to be with a WA team than all of a sudden a team that's probably in the heart of sport in Australia. So just to feel with how the Victorians react to WA, but also how they react to their fans out home, being probably the biggest fans in the country.
Oh, it's going to be really exciting. You're coming up to Sydney, no doubt, and playing the Strikers and the Sixers and the Thunder. So it should be a really good tournament.
I've got to get used to that, coming up to Sydney rather than coming across to Sydney. Don't I? Those are the terms that I've got to get used to. So, I'm really looking forward to that. And I think that's probably the hardest thing with Sydney and Victoria is having two teams in their state and all the other teams having one team. But that's what you get for being the biggest cities. You want to spread the game. You want to expose the game. And we've got enough talent around the around Australia to have eight teams in the competition, and I think it's great to have those derbies over in Sydney and Melbourne. I think it's created a lot more hype in the game rather than just having state on state. And as we've seen with the spectators, they're really getting on board with it, and the cities are slowly separating between north and south or east and west, whichever way you want to go with it. I think it's east and west over in Melbourne. Not quite sure what it is in Sydney, but I just think it's great to when you've got those two capital cities that have got a huge population. It's good to sort of have two teams in there to get a bit more excitement in the city, in the game of cricket as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a great tournament. Best of luck with the Renegades for the upcoming BBL. And thanks so much for coming on the podcast. You're actually my first Australian men's test cricketer to come on the show, so I really appreciate it.
Oh, that's all right, mate. I always like being a guinea pig, so I hope it went all right for you.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Hoggy. Best of luck this summer. We'll be following, as I said, I'll be doing a podcast on the Big Bash, so I'm going to be watching all the games, and can't wait to see you out there.
I
was just going to say it was a great book, The Wrong, and I thoroughly recommend all the listeners should pick a copy up. You know, you played with so many different characters, and just a fascinating book.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for that. It was really enjoyable, and hopefully the people that do read it, hopefully they get a bit of entertainment out of it and enjoyment as well. So, yeah, no, thank you very much for supporting the book.
Thanks, Hoggy. Take care. Good luck.
Thank you, mate. Cheers.
What a marvellous strike. He's played no better shot than that in the whole of this series.